Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 134. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around we're hitting one of the best movies of all time, one of the best thrillers of all time, and a very cool movie. If you haven't seen this one, you're going to want to. And it is, of course, the 1953 French film directed by Henri-Georges Clouzot, La Salle de la Peur, otherwise known as Wages of Fear. And to match up with that one, I'm looking at the first English language remake of the film, which is not William Friedkin's Sorcerer from 1977, as some people might think, but a 1958 Warner Brothers B picture starring Brian Keith called Violent Road. So I'm kind of comparing and contrasting the two. One is an incredibly superb film. The other one is a bit of a B movie, fairly low budget. And it's just interesting to see the two different ways that the one story is being told. So sit back, relax. I'll get the contact details done, and we'll start talking about some serious truckin' cinema. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a two-weekly podcast of classic movie appreciation. Any movie is up for grabs, except it has to be more than 20 years old at the time of recording. Now, feedback is very, very important to us. So, we have a brand new voicemail number. Please write it down. 206-202-4520. You can also send emails to cultguru@gmail.com. That is cultguru@gmail.com. Or if you're on Facebook, you can go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and check it out. You can also leave feedback at the website for the podcast, which is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. Now, you will hear some adult concepts and occasional coarse language on this podcast. So if you're offended by that, skip over that bit and enjoy the rest. Hi, how are you all doing? We're pretty fine here. Been on a two-week vacation, during which I drove up to Sydney, which is about 800-odd kilometres, a bit over 500 miles. So we drove up there to spend Easter with the family, my sister, my nephew, my soon-to-be brother-in-law, and to visit my mum as well. So we did a little bit of that, and then spent about 4 or 5 days outside Sydney, up in the Blue Mountains, looking at the beautiful Megalon and Jameson Valleys, and looking around secondhand bookshops, and walking around rainforests, and all sorts of other groovy things that don't require any real effort. Did a lot of walking, which is incredibly good exercise, of course, and just chilled out, and then came back and spent another week here at home, just mellowing out, getting some stuff done, and not entirely stressed out at all. So I'm refreshed and revived and ready to get on with the rest of the year. So, I do hope everybody is fine there. I believe it is getting warmer in the Northern Hemisphere. It's getting colder down here. Today is kind of wet and miserable. I've got the heating on in the house, which is kind of nice. And the view outside the man cave window is looking a little bit more wintry and grey and dark, which is, you know, something you've got to put up with eventually, I suppose. So nothing too great happened apart from the vacation. The driving's good. I always like a bit of country driving where I can tool around and see a bit more of the countryside. So that was all great. It's refreshing. And one thing I did discover, though, is, and this is a totally side issue, unmovie related, the meat pies in country pie shops and bakeries are fantastic. We found a couple of places in obscure places that did fantastic steak and kidney pies. So that being one of my favorite things to get when I'm out on the road, it was really nice to get some good ones. And the other interesting thing is, and of course we all know that I'm a coffee aficionado, country towns are starting to get their own coffee roasting companies that'll get the beans in raw and do their own blends and roast them up. There's a town called Wagga Wagga, which is on the way back, and it's a fairly big rural city, about 300,000 people, which is fairly big for an Australian rural city. And we just purely by accident found a coffee shop where they roast their own beans and had a break there and drank some coffee. So it's really nice to see that kind of artisanal coffee making happening there. So I'm reassured for the future of my country in spite of what our stupid federal government does. So I'm caffeinated, I'm relaxed, and I'm ready to talk about movies again. Just to open up the Letterboxd, and if you go to letterboxd.com without an E at the end of Letterboxd, and go letterboxd.com/paleocinema, one word, no dash, you'll see the movies I've been watching this year. But I'll just see what I've been watching that's interesting since last we spoke. I did do two movies for the radio gig, for the ABC local radio Darwin gig, where Liz Travaskis and I chat movies. It wasn't actually Liz that I talked to about the first movie. It was Lisa Pellegrino, who was taking over from Liz while she was on holidays. And we talked about the monkey movie Head, which was a lot of fun. Played a little bit of the monkeys. Lisa was a big fan of the monkeys, so we kind of grooved on that. Talked about the weirdness of the cinema. I've got to say that it was WTF cinema, because with the non-linear construction of Head, it's a bit hard to talk about on the radio when you don't have the visuals to show people. But we decided that I could get away with calling it WTF cinema without actually saying what the fuck. So we watched that, and I did that while I was away. I was actually at the top of the Blue Mountains in a town called Lura in our hotel room, chatting on the phone about Head. So that was a bit different. Let's see, I'm going to leave the genre stuff that I watch, because I'll talk about that over at the Martian Drive-In podcast. I did see a very bad Al Adamson movie called Blazing Stewardesses from the mid-1970s, which was the last movie done by the Ritz Brothers, who were kind of like a low-rent Marx Brothers wannabe group in the 1940s. And this one also starred Yvonne DiCarlo and a bunch of other aged actors. It's a very bad movie. I don't recommend it unless you want to be a completist for Al Adamson. And then I refreshed my palate a little bit after that one by watching the original Emmanuel with Sylvia Christel, the Zuschegan movie from about 1973, 1974. Beautifully stylish softcore porn and a little bit of fun. It didn't have as great an impact on me this time as it did when I saw it in the 1970s. But it is kind of sweet and lyrical and very pretty softcore porn. And it was nice revisiting. It was actually showing on television on cable on a movie channel called World Movies, which is a premium channel, so they can show adult content. And I watched it on that. And, yeah, it wasn't a waste of time. I think it's very pretty, and it reminds me that there was a time when erotica wasn't as pejoratively looked at as it is these days. Then I did another movie with Liz for the ABC radio gig, and it's a movie I've talked about in a very early Paleo Cinema podcast, and that's the 1948 John Negulesco film Roadhouse, starring Ida Lupino, Cornel Wilde, Celeste Holm, and Richard Widmark. And we had a bit of fun talking about that. It was a good one to talk about too, because it does have a strong female lead in it, in Ida Lupino, which was great. It was nice to kind of introduce her to a larger audience as well, which I did like giving people the access to by telling them about it and telling them why I thought it was a good film. So we did that one as well. Then I looked at a movie which is kind of taking me off at a tangent, and I'm going to have to find more of these kind of films. It's a late 1950s movie starring Jean Gabin called Maigret Lays a Trap, Maigret Tend un Piège, which is a kind of murder mystery thing with Inspector Maigret in it, which is the Georges Simenon character from the novels. And it was really good. It's set partly on the streets of Paris, and there's a nice bit of 1950s Parisian location shooting there. It's about a serial killer who murders women, knives them, and tears their clothes, but they weren't molested, and then Inspector Maigret comes along and tries to solve the murder. Really nice work, and a good little film. The plotting is kind of stuff that's been pinched by other people subsequently, so we've seen these kind of plots a number of times after this. But Jean Gabin is really good in this one, and one of the kind of suspects is played by Annie Girardot, Yeah, it just kind of led me to think, okay, we've got to find more Jean Gabin crime films, because I've seen a couple of them and I kind of liked them, but they didn't really ping on my radar as much as this one did. So I'm going to have to try to find some more Maigret films starring Jean Gabin and more of his kind of crime cinema in general. I've seen a few other things he's done. He did a movie with Ida Lupino in the 40s called Moontrap in Hollywood, because he fled to Hollywood when the Nazis took over, as any smart person would, and then went back to France afterwards. He was criticised a little bit for that. But, yeah, really kind of got me onto that trail of looking at a few, like, 1950s and 1960s French crime films. So that's going to be my next passion for the next little bit of time, based on seeing that film. Let me have a look here and see what else that I've taken a look at. And, of course, everything loads slowly when you have, when you're talking on a podcast. I did watch The Hitchhiker, a movie Ida Lupino directed, which stars Edmund O'Brien, William Talman, and who else is in it? Frank Lovejoy. It's about two guys who are off on a fishing trip, who pick up a hitchhiker who turns out to be a killer. And, yeah, it's a nice little small-budget noir movie set mostly in the deserts of North Mexico and Baja California on the peninsula there. And, yeah, Ida Lupino does some really nice little suspense bits in that film. It's, the budget was low because it was an independent movie at the time that was produced by a company which Lupino and her then-husband Collier Young were involved with. And, yeah, if you get a chance to see The Hitchhiker, it's one of those noir films she directed, along with things like Outrage, which is a movie she directed, which was one of the first Hollywood films to look at the aftermath of a rape, and from the perspective of the female victim. And she also did another one called The Bigamist with Edmund O'Brien as well, which I've got to revisit and check out at some stage. Really interesting. She was interesting as a filmmaker and interesting as an actress as well. Then last night I went over to some friend's place and we had pork belly for dinner and stuffed ourselves stupid and watched two movies which were a bit of fun. First one was A Very Harold and Kumar Christmas, because they hadn't seen it, and we got off on the doper humour of it and Danny Trejo wearing Christmas sweaters and all that kind of stuff. So that was a lot of fun. And then we saw the 1991 Joe Johnston film, The Rocketeer. Watch that one again, which is kind of cool because it's got a bunch of 1940s movie references in it. And one of their villains is supposed to be decked out like Rondo Hatton as the Creeper. And there are all these kind of little nods to older cinema in there, apart from it being a nice little kind of diesel punk action flick, which predates the term diesel punk, of course. And, yeah, we enjoyed it. It was on Blu-ray, so it was a beautifully sharp transfer. And, yeah, it definitely wasn't a waste of time, and kind of glad that I was able to share that one as well. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now. I want to get back, going to talk about the elephant in the room of the two pictures, which is the 1953 Henri-Georges Clouzot film, Wages of Fear, and then talking about Violet Road, starring Brian Keith, which isn't anywhere near as good a film, but it's got a couple of features of interest that I want to share with you. So sit back and relax, and I'll be back very soon.
Sous le ciel de Paris s'envole une chanson. Elle est née d'aujourd'hui dans le cœur d'un garçon. Sous le ciel de Paris marchent les amoureux. Leur bonheur se construit sur un air fait pour eux. Sous le pont de Bercy, un philosophe assis, deux musiciens, quelques badauds, puis des gens par milliers. Sous le ciel de Paris jusqu'au soir vont chanter l'hymne d'un peuple épris de sa vieille cité. Près de Notre-Dame, parfois couve un drame. Oui, mais à Paname, tout peut arriver. quelques rayons d'un ciel d'été, l'accordéon d'un marinier, laisse-moi fleurir au ciel de Paris. Le ciel de Paris a son secret pour lui. Depuis 20 siècles, il était pris de notre île Saint-Louis. Quand elle lui sourit, il met son habit bleu. Quand il pleut sur Paris, c'est qu'il est malheureux. Quand il est trop jaloux de ses millions d'amants, il fait gronder sur nous son tonnerre éclatant. Mais le ciel de Paris n'est pas longtemps cruel. Pour se faire pardonner, il offre un arc-en-ciel.
That was Yves Montand, the star of Wages of Fears, singing Under Paris Skies. Yves Montand was originally known as a singer. He was a music hall singer who had an affair with and came under the influence of Edith Piaf in the 1940s, and then went on to have a career before Wages of Fear as a movie star in musicals. So this was his first serious dramatic role, which is kind of an interesting arc. It parallels a little bit the careers of people like Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin, who started out as singers and then moved on to more serious stuff in some parts of their career. And also Montand starred with Marilyn Monroe in one of her last films, Let's Make Love, in 1960, which was kind of apt because they had an affair as well. But back to Wages of Fear. It's a 1953 French film directed by Henri-Georges Clouzot, who's had a really interesting career. I'll do the précis for the film, then I'll tell you about the career of Henri-Georges Clouzot, which is totally wrapped up with mid-20th century French politics. Here's the blurb that comes with Wikipedia. When a South American oil well owned by an American company catches fire, the company hires four unemployed European men, down in their luck, to drive two trucks over mountain dirt roads loaded with nitroglycerin, which is needed to extinguish the flames. That's pretty much it. It's as simple as that, but it's a lot more complicated than that. Basically, these guys have got to drive some very dodgy nitroglycerin in trucks. They've got the nitro in jerry cans on the back of the trucks, and take it across some very, very, very dodgy roads to get it to the oil well. It's set in South America, though it wasn't filmed there, and the suspense scenes in this film are unequaled. They are incredibly tense, incredibly well thought out, incredibly well filmed, and edge-of-your-seat stuff all the way through. But back to Henri-Georges Clouzot. He was in the movie industry in the early 1930s, and contracted tuberculosis and went into a sanatorium for TB cases in 1935. He didn't have much money. He was supported by friends and family and things like that. And while he was there for about 4 or 5 years, it's a little uncertain exactly how long, he read up everything he could about filmmaking. He talked to people. He read up what he could. He basically educated himself in cinema. So he finally got better. And by that time, the Germans had taken over Paris, which made things very difficult for him. He was desperately in need of money. He hadn't worked for a number of years. And a producer offered him a job making films. He accepted the job because he desperately needed the money. But as the war ended, he was tried in court for collaborating with the Germans. He wasn't exactly collaborating with the Germans, but he did make films and worked in the industry during that time. And because the Germans had taken over, there were a number of court cases for people who were involved in the industry at that time who in some cases, as with Clouseau, were in no way Nazis, but needed to basically earn a living. And his movie Le Corbeau, The Raven, which was made just towards the end of the German occupation, had the weird honour of being banned both by the Germans and by the French once Paris was liberated. So at the start of things, during this court case, Clouseau was banned from making films for the rest of his life in France. This was then, there were a whole bunch of people who were supporters of Clouseau, knew his talent and knew his skill and knew the true story, who supported him. And a lot of them were quite influential people in the media at the time, which did help out a lot. I mean, people like Jean Cocteau, René Clair, Marcel Carnet, Jean-Paul Sartre, for whom Clouseau had worked when he wasn't able to work in cinema for a little bit. All went up against, they opposed the ruling. The sentence was shortened from life to 2 years. And during that 2 years banishment, Clouseau worked for Sartre, who had defended the film Le Corbeau. So Clouseau's, before he got to TV, and that, Clouseau's films in the industry were a lot lighter. But he got TB. He went through this time under the Nazi occupation. He went through the court cases and things like that. And the films he made subsequent to that, which weren't many, there weren't a terribly large amount of them, were much darker and much more critical of authority than previous films he'd made. So, roll on to 1953. The war's been over for 8 years. And Clouseau's got hold of a very interesting novel by a guy called Georges Arnaud, The Wages of Fear. Clouseau hired Yves Montand, who was known as a light actor. He was married at the time to the actress Simone Signoret, who appeared in Les Diaboliques, one of the subsequent films that Clouseau did. Now, Clouseau wanted to film in Spain because they had the rough, rugged countryside that he needed to tell the story. The climate was a little bit warmer than some parts of France, and so he wanted to make it in Spain. But Yves Montand, who was very political, and as indeed was Simone Signoret, said, no, I'm not going to work ever in Spain while Francisco Franco runs the country. And he never did. So Clouseau accepted that. He accepted the judgment. He wanted to get Montand in the film. So they decided to make it down in the Camargue in the south of France. The Camargue is an interesting area. It's kind of limestoney and got some very unusual landscapes that aren't really what we think of when we think of French countryside. In fact, one of Hammer's films was made down at the Camargue, the movie Maniac, starring Kerwin Matthews, and the scenery shows up well in that as well. But anyway, so he's got Yves Montand on board. He wants Jean Gabon to play the older male truck driver in the film, a character called Monsieur Joe. Gabon thinks about it for a while, and Gabon decides, no, I'm not going to play it because my fans won't want me to play coward. And so Jean Gabon passes on it, and a character actor called Charles Vanel gets the job. So there are two other characters to cast. There's Bimba, who's a little bit of an enigmatic character, and he chooses Peter van Eyck, who was born in Pomerania, which was then Germany but is now Poland, in 1911, and was very much anti-Nazi, which is odd because Peter van Eyck is mostly known for playing Nazi characters. It's one of those curses that certain expatriate actors got in Hollywood. People like Conrad Veidt, for instance, always played Nazis, even though they're anti-Nazi. In the early 30s, he left Germany and went to Hollywood. He worked as a truck driver for a while there. He got radio work with the help of Billy Wilder, who was always helping out expatriates, and went on to have a fairly long career, right up until 1969, when he played one of the generals in The Bridge at Remagen, the movie with George Segal in 1969. So, I mean, people might know him from a few other films. He was in Station 6 Sahara. He was in The Longest Day. He was in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. He played a German in that film as well. And he was also in a Hammer film called The Snorkel, which is one of the minor Hammer crime films, but is quite interesting as well. And so, again, an ex a victim of Nazis in a sense, went on to play Nazis in cinema. And Peter Van Eyck's Bimba is an interesting character who is at first quite distant and professional and cold. But he's driving, there's two trucks. There's a larger truck which has Joe and Mario in it, Yves Montand and Charles Vanel. And there's the smaller truck which has Bimba, played by Peter Van Eyck, and an interesting Italian character actor in it who plays the other character whose name, somewhat cliched, is Luigi, and his name is Focolulli. Focolulli, interesting actor. And he did over 100 films in Italian cinema, and he's kind of looks a little bit stereotypically Italian. He's got curly hair, he's a little bit chubby, he's got a mustache, and he's kind of big gestures in it. And his character Luigi, every character has an arc, and one of the interesting things about Wages of Fear is that the characters, with the exception of Bimba, whose character is established towards the end of the film, all the characters are established at the start when in this grimy little dusty hot no hope town, and Luigi gets a diagnosis from the doctor just before the American oil company, Southern Oil Company, comes in looking for drivers who are willing to drive these incredibly dangerous trucks. Luigi gets a diagnosis from the doctor telling him that he's got cement in his lungs from working in the cement works. I assume that's some kind of silicosis or something like that. He's got about anywhere up to 12 months to live, but he's on his way out. And Luigi's a fairly simple guy. He likes to drink, he likes to dance, he likes to enjoy himself and work hard and that kind of stuff. So he's not a complicated character, but suddenly he's been given this death sentence. And he wants to get enough money to enjoy himself for the rest of his life, which is his motivation for going on this incredibly dangerous journey. Then you have Mario, played by Yves Montand, who is very poor and is kind of infatuated and possibly having an affair with Linda, the girl who runs the little cantina where, well, she works in the cantina where the expatriates all hang out waiting for work or waiting for some money or waiting just for anything to happen. She's played by Vera Clouseau, who was the wife of Henri-Georges Clouseau. She only did four films, all of which were for her husband. Three films. She did this one. She did Les Diaboliques against Simon Signoret. And she did a movie called Les Espions, which was The Spies, which was one of his movies in the late 1950s. She died very early. She was at the age of 46. She died of a heart attack. You know, if you look through the history of cinema, you see so many people dying of these diseases that now would be managed. She was walking down the streets in Paris and died of a heart attack, which is quite sad. And she is quite memorable in this film as well. She's the first time you see her, she's on her hands and knees scrubbing the floor of the cantina, wearing a very low-cut blouse, and very attractive lady. That's all I'm going to say, but you can enjoy that part of things as well. So, all four of the... And then you got Joe, played by Charles Vanel. Joe comes into town wearing a big hat and talking big. He comes into an aeroplane and stops at the cantina and starts acting like the big man in town and putting people down and just basically acting like a big shot. He isn't. He's as down on his luck as any of them, but he puts on a big front to because he's got an enormous ego. He's an incredibly egotistical man. He makes friends with Mario because they both know Paris. Mario's actually Corsican, but he lived in Paris for a long time, and Joe's very nostalgic for France and Paris, the kind of the way people were in the movie Papillon. He's nostalgic for Paris and things like that, and Joe sees that Mario has a metro ticket to get to Pigalle Station on the Paris metro and keeps it as a kind of keepsake with him. So Joe befriends Mario, but he's an asshole. He's egotistical. There's a scene after they sign up where they're in the cantina and Luigi wants to buy a bottle of champagne and share it around with his friends and things like that. And he and Joe have a confrontation, which Joe basically pulls a gun on him. And kind of shames Luigi into backing down in a big way. So we get to the point where the oil company needs somebody to go out with this nitroglycerin because they've got an oil fire at a very remote location, about 300 miles away from the town. They need someone to get the nitro there so they can basically blow the the flaming oil rig, and put out the fire with the explosion. Now, this is the other interesting part of this film, which is that American oil companies don't come off well in it. They don't give a shit about these guys. They're offering them $5,000. They're going to lose $500,000 if they don't get this oil rig capped. And so they basically put them into these two trucks, which have been serviced and everything, and send them off 5 minutes apart or half an hour apart, so that they can hopefully one of them will get through with the nitroglycerin in these jerry cans attached to the back of the trucks and allow them to cap the oil well. And basically they're hired, they decide who's going into which truck, and Joe and Mario head off first. And Joe's driving quite slowly. He's being very slow and very careful. They take off at night in these trucks. The roads are not good, and you don't want to bump the nitro too much, or otherwise it will explode. And Joe's driving slow and then says he's sick and he may have a touch of malaria and things like that. And it's slowly discovered that Joe is essentially a coward and is terrified of driving this truck, even though he wasn't one of the original picks for it. He was deemed too old by the oil company, and another man was picked, but that other man mysteriously disappeared, and the implication is that Joe killed him to get the job. So basically Mario finds out that Joe is totally chicken shit and has totally lost his nerve and has to basically carry him through the rest of the journey, which is kind of interesting because in town Joe's a big shot. As soon as shit gets real, Joe is an utter coward. And Mario basically beats him up and shames him a lot because he shouldn't have come here. He's putting Mario's life at risk by being what he is. And he basically should not be where he is. So we then get into the journey of the film. And this is a fantastic piece. There are a few set pieces that really stand out in this film, one of which is there's a grade where you've got to go a certain speed so that the road isn't bumpy. You know, there are corrugations on the road, and if you go at a certain speed, the ride's smooth. If you go too slow, the ride's very bumpy, and that, of course, agitates the nitroglycerin. And at this stage, the other truck with Bimba and Luigi in it has gone around Mario and Joe and is up ahead. And Bimba is telling Luigi to go at a certain speed, and otherwise they won't get up the grade and things like that, not knowing that the other truck behind them is barreling down on them at the right speed. And if they don't, and it's a one-lane road, if they don't speed up soon, they're going to collide. And there's a really tense scene where the trucks are coming close to each other, and Mario and Joe are behind and coming up really fast. In the front, Bimba and Luigi are trying to accelerate these enormous old trucks. And it's a really nice little tense piece there. Then they come to a hairpin turn on a mountain road further up the road, where you've got to basically do a three-point turn, backing onto a platform over a ravine, which is made of quite dodgy wood. So they've got to kind of go forward, back onto this platform, and then forward to go up the other part of the hairpin turn. And that, again, is really, really a tense thing, and they do exactly the right thing. Clouseau does exactly the right thing with that part of the film, because the smaller truck is in the front now, and the smaller truck almost falls through the platform while backing up onto this platform to do the three-point turn. We know that the heavier truck has still to do that, and that's where things get really interesting, and there's an incredibly tense piece there. Then there's another incredibly tense set piece where a boulder has fallen down the road, and it's not a small boulder, it's the size of basically a sedan. And it's decided by Bimba and Mario, that what they need to do is drill a hole down through the limestone rock, put some nitro in there and blow it. And again, there's the tension there, which is really great and realistic. And Clouseau takes his time to make sure that everything is done exactly right. It's not one of those action scenes that are rushed through. It's done exactly right. The first problem is, of course, pouring nitroglycerin from a jerry can into a thermos flask so you can transfer it into the hole once the hole is powdered through the rock by Luigi using a great big pole, metal pole. Then you've got the problem of getting the nitro into the hole. Then you've got the problem of setting off the nitro. Then you've got the problem of being far enough back that when the nitro blows and blows up that rock, you are not going to be pounded with boulders and rocks from the explosion. So there are all these different steps in the danger in this action scene, which are really laid out well. And there's not a moment of it that's wasted time in the way Clouseau does it. The two trucks are one behind the other. Bimba's got things under control. He knows what to do. But the other guys are supporting him. And it's just tense as hell. And then there's two more set pieces, which I'm not going to spoil for you by telling you anything at all about them, but they do end dramatically, let's say that. They end very dramatically. And then, of course, there's the end of the film, which is, again, I'm not going to spoil for you at all, which is just fantastically right and incredibly stupid at the same time. Not stupid in the sense of the filmmakers being stupid, but in the sense of a character being stupid. So, this film is really fantastic. Of course, it was remade by William Friedkin in 1977 and in 1958 by Howard W. Koch. But the original here is just one of the great pieces of French cinema, one of the great pieces of suspense cinema as well. I hadn't seen it for about 10 years when I watched it again yesterday, and I'd forgotten the fine detail of things. I could kind of remember the vague detail, but I'd forgotten the fine detail of the action sequences and the character pieces in the town and while they're driving as well, which let me take the whole ride fresh in a sense. I knew what the ending was going to be and how it would play out, but it didn't stop me enjoying the ride at all. It's just great. I think that this is one of those movies that's a template for people making other films, but subsequent to it, but the template which a lot of people ignore. Establishing the characters before the action is so crucial in this kind of suspense film because the audience has to care about the characters. They have to give a shit about what these guys are doing, why they're doing it, what the barriers are to them doing it, and all of that comes from character, and that's the thing that a lot of action films forget. You've got to not necessarily like the characters, because Mario in particular does a few things for which we don't like him at all, but you have to understand them and you have to know why they're doing what they're doing in a clear way before the action starts, and this film does that perfectly. And there are a few bits which you wouldn't have seen in an American film of the 1950s as well. There's the fact that Linda in the cantina has to sleep with her boss regularly as a part of her employment. That would never have happened in a movie of an American film of the 1950s without there being some kind of comeuppance for the cantina manager, which there never is in the film. It's just a part of this world that they're in. The fact that it's a very hard world and everybody has to live hard to survive in it. That's all part of that. And there's another scene, too, that when they finally do blow up the boulder to celebrate, all the guys piss into the hole where the boulder was. You don't see them pissing, but you see them kind of undoing their pants and just kind of standing around the hole a little bit. And again, you wouldn't see that in an American film of the time, one tiny bit. But in this movie, it works. You think, yeah, these guys have just done something very dangerous and have prevailed. And yeah, they want to mark their territory by pissing in the hole. And indeed, they do. This movie is... It's just one of those films where you sit back after you watch it and go, wow. Doesn't matter whether you've seen it before or not. It's tense. The acting is superb as well. The arc for people like Joe, played by Charles Vanel, is incredibly good. The person he is at the start and the person he is at the end of the film are incredibly different people. You see him destroyed by the fear that he has for this journey. You see Mario too coming out of complacency into confidence, which doesn't always serve him well as the film progresses, but you do see that. You see Luigi and Bimba form a friendship, and Bimba explaining to Luigi why he is the man he is, and shaving in the mirror because he wants to look good, in spite of the fact that they're in the middle of some really shitty terrain and nobody's ever going to see him. And he explains his reasons for wanting to shave and look after himself in that circumstance. And Luigi kind of treasures that friendship and treasures the adventure and the life that they have while doing this dangerous work. So all of the characters kind of have an arc, which may not end well in all cases, but at least it's satisfying to them to a certain extent. And that's really... I've got Les Diaboliques and Les Espions to watch after I finish the podcast. I'll probably do it over the next few days. And I'm really looking forward to that. This guy was a master filmmaker. He is not as well known as a lot of other people. I mean, he should be at least as well known as Hitchcock, but Hitchcock's got the advantage of having had a very long career, whereas Clouseau hasn't. I think that Hitchcock learned from Clouseau in some of his later films. He really does learn from the way that Henri-Georges Clouseau filmed, particularly this film, and Les Diaboliques. It's really a lovely piece of filmmaking. I'm going to have to get the Criterion edition for all the extras. I've got a local Australian edition on DVD from a few years back, but it seems to be missing one or two scenes, which I have watched on YouTube. Those scenes, fortunately, are on YouTube, and I have been able to see them. But I do want to get that complete version. I want to get the Criterion one. If anybody wants to buy it for me, go ahead. But, yeah, this film, mind-blowingly good. I haven't seen Sorcerer for a long time, so I can't really compare it with the Friedkin one. I don't particularly want to see Sorcerer for a while after seeing Wages of Fear. I think I want to wait a little bit before I hunt it down and watch it again. I did see it in the 1970s, but I've only got very vague memories of it. But anyway, I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, I'm going to look at the kind of watered down, but not uninteresting, and unacknowledged remake of Wages of Fear from 1958, which is Howard W. Koch's Violet Road.
Now, you ought to take it easy, Nelson. I know about the troubles you've been having around here. I got a friend, see? She's a kind of a close personal friend. Walker's secretary. So I know about the explosions you had, and I know about that runaway rocket that cracked up. I know you got to move this plant out of here, too, before the town moves it for you. That's if there's any town left by then.
Wow. You got yourself quite a little grapevine.
That's right.
What else?
Well, Walker would shrink his own mother's head for a buck. He'd even run the risk of getting the insurance canceled on his trucks and his drivers. So if he turns down this hall, it must be pretty hot.
Not too hot for you?
Well, I'm not allergic to a buck either. Only I got no insurance to lose. No trucks, no drivers, no nothing.
Trucking outfit with no trucks and no drivers. Bargain day.
Right. Now, you got a deadline, haven't you? You need 3 trucks and 6 drivers. Walker was the bottom of the barrel. It's too late for you to put out a call for Wildcat drivers. You can't risk that anyway. Now, I know trucks and I know drivers. I can smell them. You supply the trucks and I'll dig up the drivers for you right here in your own plant. What have you got to haul? I'll haul it where it's going. Okay, sport. It's your $10 million. I just came looking for a job. You want me, I'll be around. What I saw of this town, it won't be hard to find either.
That was Brian Keith and Ed Prentice with some dialogue from the 1958 Warner Brothers B-movie Violent Road, which is an unacknowledged remake of Wages of Fear, and a very different film for a number of reasons. Now, I was thinking about the two in comparison and comparing the original, Les Salades de la Peur, with this movie is a bit like comparing a professional athlete with some kid who'd had his leg broken 6 months before running around a track. They do the same thing pretty much, but the comparison's not realistic. This was never meant to be an A picture at all. It's got a whole bunch of contract players from Warner Brothers at the time in it. It's very low budget. It was filmed in the Alabama Hills, kind of east of Los Angeles, same place where Randolph Scott filmed the renowned movies in the 1950s. So I don't think they bumped into each other, but it's around the same territory as those beautiful weathered old hills that we know from a number of westerns. In fact, some bits at the start of Django Unchained were filmed in pretty much the same area. So the story in this version in Violent Road is this. A trucking company, it's all very space-age stuff, a company that launches rockets has to move out of a town because there's been an accident just recently and one of their malfunctioning rockets landed on a school and killed a bunch of people. So all of the plants being moved out, but there's still some rocket fuel components that need to be moved out. There's a truckload of nitric acid. There's a truckload of 100% concentrated hydrogen peroxide. And there's another truckload of hydrazine, all of which need to go together to make rocket fuel. None of the professional trucking companies will touch this stuff because it's just so dodgy. And they can't take it on a highway because all the local towns won't permit them to drive through the towns in order to get this stuff to their new location, which is much more remote, much more safe place to conduct aerospace research, particularly practical aerospace research. So the only way to get this stuff to where it needs to be is to get whichever drivers they can using the Kenworth trucks they've got and take them across some very dodgy old mountain roads to the new location, avoiding all towns and therefore avoiding the problem. So Brian Keith comes along. He's a kind of rebel trucker. And we first see him getting out of the convertible of a very attractive woman played by Mary Anders. And there's some kind of tough guy dialogue that goes on between them two, which I'm going to play for you now because one of the virtues of this film, which, again, is not anywhere near as good as Wages of Fear, is the kind of tough guy dialogue. It almost borders on kind of satire of this kind of dialogue. But I'll play it for you and you'll understand what I mean.
Thanks for the ride. Been a million laughs.
You showed your appreciation.
It wasn't hard to do. Where to now?
Wherever the sun or the road map takes me. One place, one town, the same as the next.
Story of my life.
You staying around here long?
Well, it depends on what the man in there says.
And if he says no?
Well, I'll follow the sun or I'll find somebody else who's got a road map. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
Take care now. Next fella you pick up might not have my kind of polite manners.
It's nice of you to have my interests at heart.
Well, it's not exactly that, see. I knew a girl one time. All she did was go out and park one night with a blind date. A year later, she had to get a divorce.
Coward?
Nah, the thought of something like that happening to me could turn me into a real hard type fella to find.
Don't lose any sleep. Forget it. I'm a big girl. I stopped, I picked you up, I gave you a ride. Like he said, a million laughs.
Hey, wait a minute, I don't even know your name.
See what I mean? It's almost a kind of satire of tough guy dialogue, but it makes it a bit more entertaining than it is. So you've got Brian Keith in there playing the kind of rebel truck driver. He's got his sleeves rolled up, but he's a burly, beefy kind of guy who likes a dame and a smoke and a drink now and then. A little bit of a cliched character, but I kind of looked into the history of Brian Keith as an actor, and very interesting guy. His father, Robert Keith, played the cop who keeps trying to arrest Skye Masterson in Guys and Dolls. His father was an actor for a very long time. And for a short time in the 1920s, Robert Keith was married to Peg Entwistle, who we know for one single sad fact. Peg Entwistle was the woman who committed suicide, jumping off the H in the Hollywood sign in 1932. So that means that at one time she was Brian Keith's stepmother. which is kind of interesting if you know your Hollywood history, particularly about Peg Entwistle. But Brian Keith, interesting actor. People know him from TV shows like Family Affair and The Brian Keith Show and things like that. But he's one of those character actors who never really hit his stride, in a sense. He's very good in a few of these kind of early films, and he did a kind of journeyman task doing these silly sitcoms and things like that, but he was a good, solid character actor. He was actually a Marine in World War II, and he was a tail gunner in a two-man dive bomber during the war. So, you know, he was one of those tough guy actors who really was tough and really did pay his dues as far as acting tough in movies. He had the reality to back it up, so he wasn't a wuss at all. But in the end, unfortunately, because of years and years and years of smoking, even though he'd given up 10 years before he died, he was suffering from emphysema and lung cancer at the time of his death, and shot himself at his home in Malibu in the early 1990s. So a little bit of a sad ending for him, but I do like him in these tough guy roles. He puts it across very well and very realistically. And he's one of those things where he's no better than the movie has to be, but he's it. Now, I've got to talk about this because, it amuses the fuck out of me. Remember the curse of paleo cinema, where when I talk about actors in movies, soon after I talk about them, they die. This movie also stars Efren Zimbalist Jr., who died a couple of days ago, probably around the time I was watching this movie. Not my fault, didn't kill him this time. It's kind of another one of those marvellous coincidences of timing. But Efren Zimbalist Jr. plays one of the scientists at the Rocket Center who goes along as an observer and to assist in the truck. Each of the three trucks has two people in it, and he's one of those. Now, Efren Zimbalist Jr., I never particularly liked as an actor. I have very little reluctance to speak ill of the dead, but I think he did his job. People know him from TV series The FBI and things like that. He was also the voice of Alfred in some of the Batman cartoons right up until a few years ago. So if you look at any of the early Batman cartoons, Efren Zimbalist Jr.'s voice was Alfred the Butler in some of those cartoons. But yeah, I never thought of him. He's a bit of a stiff actor in a sense, but in this one, he does get a little bit of an emotional arc. He was a family man whose family is no longer around, and the movie explains why that is. And he does a pretty sterling job of it. But there are a couple of other actors in this film that are quite interesting as well, and for whom I've got a little bit of a time. One of the drivers is played by a character actor called Perry Lopez. And the name may strike a bell with some people because he played Lou Escobar, the cop who was a friend of Jake Gillies in Chinatown and in The Two Jakes. So Perry Lopez is in here as a young actor. I think he may have been a jobbing actor around the same time as Jack Nicholson's career started. So I think that their friendship is one of the reasons why he's in Chinatown. But he plays Manuelo, who's a mechanic that goes along for the ride. You got Arthur Batanides, who played villains in any number of TV series in the 1960s. As soon as you see his face, you'll know that you know who he is and what he was. He was in TV series all the way up to, he did Police Academy movies. He did Wonder Woman, he did Ironside, McCloud, Mission Impossible, about six times playing different characters. Bearcats with Rod Taylor, he was in an episode of that. Daniel Boone, It Takes a Thief. Wild Wild West, he did a number of episodes in, and things like that. I think he also may have done an episode or two of Star Trek back in the day. But anyway, he's in there as one of the other drivers. Sean Garrison's in there playing a young hotshot driver whose brother was supposed to be the driver for the truck, but has a drinking problem, and he goes on the journey because each one of the drivers is getting $5,000, and that $5,000 will help him help his brother dry out. Now, Sean Garrison, I know from one other movie alone, didn't have a long career. He was a contract player at Warner Brothers at the time, but I've talked about a movie with Sean Garrison in it before on Paleo Cinema. Dr. Zom and I talked about a golfing movie called Banning, and Sean Garrison's in that playing the guy who is Robert Wagner's character's golfing partner in the Calcutta golfing tournament that goes on in there. So he had a career at least into the 1960s. Not a terribly long career and not a terribly memorable actor. And that's one of the things about this film. There's not anybody apart from one other person and Brian Keith that really stands out in this movie. And that other person is Dick Foran, a character actor who had a long career playing Sarge. He's a World War II veteran. He's obviously got post-traumatic stress disorder. He's a bit of an alcoholic, but he's sent on the trip and has an accident during the trip. I'm not going to spoil it because you can find this movie if you search around hard enough. There was a DVD release of it back in the 2000s, which I haven't been able to find. But if anybody's got a link, got a connection with Cinemageddon, there is a VHS rip of it, which is the one I saw, over at Cinemageddon. So he had a career with Warner Brothers way back in the 1940s. He was in Black Legion with Humphrey Bogart, for instance, and a whole bunch of other films as well. And this one he does pretty well and brings a bit of depth and a bit of character to playing Sarge, the kind of slightly rummy and drunk but trying to get his shit together war veteran. His wife's played by Anne Doran, an actress, a character actress whose face you'll recognise as well. And there are some scenes with her which are quite touching and memorable. But the essence of these kind of films is the action, and some of the action is kind of good. They're going over some roads which aren't anywhere near as dodgy as the roads in Wages of Fear, but they've still got their problems. Trucks break down. There are rock falls that threaten the trucks as well. And there's a great scene with Perry Lopez. I don't know whether he did the stunt work himself or whether somebody else did. But they've got a boulder tumbling down. It's about to hit one of the trucks. And this is a totally silly stunt. And in reality, it probably would have shattered both his legs. But Perry Lopez's character drop kicks the rock out of the way. So he does a flying drop kick. And the rock gets diverted out of the way. And it's a nice little bit of stunt work too. It's beautifully timed and beautifully performed. But the physics don't match up with it in reality because rocks are heavy. And he kicks this one out of the way nicely. And this film's in a long tradition of Warner Brothers working man's films where the protagonists and the heroes are all working stiffs. And Warner Brothers was very egalitarian in that way all the way back to the 1930s. And this is a kind of egalitarian working stiff movie. If you didn't know that it was a remake of Wages of Fear and you hadn't seen Wages of Fear and didn't know how good a film that is, this would stand alone as a nice 1950s B-movie action pick with some interesting characters. It plays a lot like, I mean, in the 1950s, Warner Brothers started doing TV shows like 77 Sunset Strip and Surfside 6 and all of those kind of things. And it plays a little bit about like an extended episode of one of them, in a sense. It's got a lot of the same production values as those TV shows. And Warner Brothers was struggling as a studio in the 1950s. And so it was diversifying into television. And a lot of these actors played in TV as well as in movies, in B pictures or in minor roles in A pictures that Warner Brothers was doing at the time. There's a lot of crossover there among this stable of actors. And this was just before the end of the studio system where actors were contracted to studios in a kind of indentured servitude. But, I watched this one immediately after I watched Wages of Fear, which was probably a mistake, but I found enough in it to like that it wasn't really a waste of my time. Brian Keith's pretty good there. He gets a scene with his shirt off, and there's lots of guys with spanners and fixing things. There's a scene where there's a leak in the tanker that's holding nitric acid, and one of the characters does something very dumb in it, which is not inconsistent with the character as well. So just to summarise it, I think people who've seen Wages of Fear, you should see Violent Road for the simple reason that you can see how very different two films can be when they have essentially the same plot lines. I think one of the problems is that, of course, there was still the studio censorship in the 1950s, and for that reason this movie doesn't have a lot of the grittiness and a lot of the reality and a lot of the earthiness of Wages of Fear. The script also gets a bit weakened by the fact that all three trucks have to make it through for the guys to get their money. So there's no possibility of them being unsuccessful. So in a sense, the script stacks the deck in the guys succeeding at what they're doing, even if not all of them make it back successfully. It's really one of those... I think it feels rushed in a sense. I think the scripting and the filming of it seem rushed. And they said, hey, why don't we do a version of Wages of Fear? Put it together, did it on a shoestring budget, got in some actors who can be earnest and honest in what they're doing with it, and played it through. But it's good to see Brian Keith doing a kind of action role rather than playing the cute uncle in Family Affair or the crotchety old judge in Hardcastle and McCormack and the TV series that he did in the 1980s and stuff like that. I think he's a good, honest, working stiff actor in this particular movie. And he is quite watchable in it as well. There's a lot of fun there. I think his tongue's slightly in his cheek with some of the dialogue. There's some really great little things he says, like when one of the guys fucks up, he says, you put a little stunt like that again and I'll rub your head in the sand till it's hamburger, which is kind of a lovely mental image and kind of works well in the context of that kind of working man stuff. And I kind of like the idea of rubbing someone's head in the sand until it turns to hamburger. That's a tough guy kind of thing to say. And he puts it across very, very well. Now, in the sense that this is, because this isn't as tense, even though there is tension in the film, even though it isn't as tense as Wages of Fear, I still think it's entertaining. And though the ending is a little bit soft, it is kind of an ending you'd expect from a film like this. It's not as good as either of the two films, Wages of Fear or Sorcerer as well, but I kind of enjoyed matching it up with Wages of Fear for the simple contrast of a very simplified and dumbed down and quick and easy approach to the same material being made by this film. And any movie that starts with a schoolyard being blown up with kids and mothers and things like that in it has a lot to live up to, and I'm not entirely sure that this film does, but it's kind of an interesting moment of 1950s paranoia when that scene occurs in the film. So anyway, that's about it for this time around. Again, I haven't had any feedback now. Again, I'm feeling terribly lonely here. I may cry after this and curl up in a corner and rock back and forth with a blanket over my head. So definitely want feedback. cultguru@gmail.com, or you can go to the voicemail line. Either one is fine. Let me know how I'm going and let me know what you think of the movies that I've talked about. I do have a movie-related question to throw out there just as a little bit of a feeder for any potential feedback. Name one remake that you hated more than any other. It doesn't have to be in the paleo cinema era, but which remake really pisses you off the most? Which remake do you want everybody involved with to die in a horrible way? So that's just a thought for you. For me, I don't really have any that I hate with a passion, but I've talked with a few people on Facebook who have very strong opinions on this particular matter. So let me know what you think. And anyway, I'll be back in 2 weeks with another film or two. Look after yourselves, watch some good films, watch some bad films, eat a lot of popcorn and beef jerky and have a beer or two while you're enjoying them. And I'll be back very soon. Bye.